From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the program on this Monday morning. I'm a bit concerned about George the AI. He said that we shouldn't trust a computer that we can't throw out the window. That was according to Wozniak. Steve, I don't know. I haven't seen George in the studio this morning, but I don't know if we can throw him out the window. So if we can't, what does it say about his news reading? I just don't know. I just don't know. It's an important question, but one which we're not going to be able to answer today. We are going to be answering some other questions for you today. However, on the show, what are we talking about? Well, we're going to be looking at the state of dialogue in the national dialogues that was in the news, as well as in our own Jewish community. I'm going to be talking about the Mamdani Jews versus the neo-neocons of New York. That's an interesting discussion that we are hopefully going to be having. We're going to be looking at wine. I'm no wine expert, but we're going to talk about wine from 1500 years ago. So that's kind of interesting that they are growing in Israel. We're going to be talking about a light item with regards to the Joburg City Library. And also, we will be talking about the hostages that have been coming up through the system here in the community in the last while, and what does that mean for our role in the war, I guess, as the Jewish community in South Africa. That is all coming up on the show. And the other part of the show that we would really like to have you as part of is the discussion. If you have something that you would like to add to the discussion, 061-895-1019. That is the line, 061-895-1019. And then we will be able to take your calls and your discussions. So that is what is going to be going on at the moment. That is all there. So please do be part of the discussion. So where shall we start? Let's talk about these national dialogues. I think that that's not a bad option. We have sort of, for the purposes of this discussion, two national dialogues going on. The one is this national dialogue announced by President Ramaphosa that's supposed to like get all South Africans together to chart a new way forward. It hasn't started, I have to say, particularly well. We've had people coming in. We've had people pulling out. Basically, if you look at the list of so-called eminent persons who are supposed to be being part of this dialogue, they, there's not really any opposition figures. There's no people from, say, like respected figures in the Afrikaans community. Basically, no one who doesn't disagree with the president is there. And now we have this interesting situation where you have these foundations that are refusing to participate because of various issues. And that's kind of interesting, because what is a foundation eventually, right? There's this Mbeki Foundation, there's the Biko Foundation, there's the Tutu Foundation, there's the Ed W. de Klerk Foundation, there's the Tambo Foundation. These are all part of these foundations that have pulled out. And I think it's a kind of interesting part of our politics now that we have this happening, because a foundation is effectively a bunch of money with a board, and you'll find the board is normally of sort of kind of senior people, political figures, whatever. And by using the name of a sort of either departed person or a person who is no longer in control, they sort of make use of the spirit of that person in some way to perpetuate what they see as their ideas and their contribution. So what it sort of comes down to is a kind of civil society interest group who represents a kind of philosophy connected to that person. And so I think it'd be an interesting political exercise to be done to see who and what do these foundations represent. you know, they kind of saying, well, you know, this dialogue is not being done by properly. It's not being done in a way that is connected to the people. But they don't. These foundations are not really all that connected to the people either. They're essentially elite institutions with lots of money, with key political figures who are driving a particular political narrative, which, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with. You know, they make a contribution to the discourse, and they're part of the discussion and can be very useful for legal things and keeping the government to account. But you've kind of got this kind of rule from the grave of people who are no longer with us, who are like putting forward their particular political perspectives. And it's what's often happens with these sorts of foundations is that what the original founder intended to be for the foundation gets taken over by other people with other viewpoints, and then it sort of it doesn't really represent what's going on with the current foundation. I mean, we had this big argument, for example, with the Helen Suzman Foundation at one point, where they were hosting Imtiaz Suleiman and doing a lot of anti-Israel activism, and that's not something, you know, that Helen Suzman would have appreciated. So that is a very interesting issue, and one which you sort of have to be careful with these sorts of foundations, because they do tend to get taken over. So what do they actually represent? And as I say, I think there is an interesting political discussion to be had. Like, who actually is, you know, the Tambo Foundation? It's not Tambo. We know that. It might not even be the family of Tambo anymore. So, you know, what actually is it? So, you know, I don't know. I haven't looked. Maybe there's some members from Tambo's family. But the point is it's not Tambo himself. So it's interesting to see that these groups who also kind of profess to be on board with the government's agenda and the Ramaphosa's agenda to have this dialogue have said, well, you know, we're not interested. So that is the one set of dialogues which I wanted to talk about, and just like the interesting state of dialogue. My cynical view of the national dialogue is that the amount of money which is being spent, which is like 700 million rand, it sounds to me more like an ANC kind of campaign on the light, without saying the ANC, but, you know, the president can get all this time with his dialogue and in front of the cameras and be shown to be doing something even though he's not. And so I think that is kind of where this is going. It's not really a dialogue so much as an ANC election campaign, and because, you know, they're not including really anyone who's prepared to disagree. A dialogue is in basically a disagreement process. So that is my view on the national dialogues. We, on the other side of the break, we will be talking about the Jewish dialogue and where that is at. So, you know, do stay with us. It's going to stay interesting. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
I am Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM. And I will actually be at Limud for the weekend. So if you are wanting to be part of that, I would really suggest that you go ahead and do so. But you have to do it quickly. And if you can't get in for the weekend, come for the Sunday. It really is always a lot of fun. And I'm certainly looking forward to it. And hopefully we'll get to see some of you listeners at Chai FM to be part of the conversation. By the way, if you do want to be part of the conversation, you can definitely do so. You can send us a WhatsApp on 061-895-1019. That's 061-895-1019, not one time, as we continue our various topics today. Now, before the break, we were talking about the national dialogues. Let's talk about this Jewish dialogue. This is this one that's being run by the Jewish Report newspaper, where they get different opinion editors to opinion people to actually say something about the state of the community, and lots of people have been engaging in this to actually get a sense about where the community is at. And I thought I would comment on one that I saw over the weekend. This one was done anonymously, which I thought was kind of interesting. I haven't seen an anonymous one yet. And what was interesting for me about it is that They basically made a whole bunch of points about the structure of the community, the funding of the community, which is obviously a big deal at the moment with this discussion around school closures, the various applicability of different Jewish organizations in terms of politics, and a couple of other things about the difference between Cape Town and Joburg and all of that sort of thing. Now, what's interesting for me, first off, about this article is that they chose to be anonymous. It's not like, you know, you have someone here who's sort of come out with some strong anti-Israel opinion and they want to, you know, protect themselves. Basically, you have a person here who claims to be some sort of communal leader, not clear what, but they want to, you know, talk about communal affairs, and they're not necessarily saying anything that controversial or different or anything, but it is a you know, it is a question, you know, it is a question about how do I say it? A question about, like, if you're not going to say anything that controversial, why do you have to be anonymous? Now, a lot of people say that in our community, you know, if you criticize Israel, for example, then you're going to be called an anti-Semite. Well, first of all, I didn't really criticize Israel in this discussion. I also tend to, and while that might be true, I also tend to find that people who make that claim often just don't want to be disagreed with. It's not that they are being attacked or anything. They just, you know, they don't like someone saying, well, actually, you're wrong. And that's, now I don't know if that's the case, but we don't know because this is an anonymous person. So, you know, maybe I know this person, maybe I don't. But the point is that maybe there's some sort of position. I found it odd that they were having an anonymous discussion around something which was heated, but not necessarily controversial. It's someone giving their opinion on communal affairs, which everyone should have a right to do. And perhaps there's not really a need, in my view, for anonymity in this particular case. Perhaps this person's business interests or communal interests that they feel would clash, and so, or whatever. So whatever, the anonymity I thought was interesting, but not necessarily, I thought, necessary. Now let's talk about some substance discussion with this thing. Right, one part of the letter, they talk about, what is the role of different communal organizations, and what they should be doing? How much should they be talking about Israel? How much are they talking about local issues? How much are they talking about spiritual issues? And some of the issues that they raise are legitimate, you know, about interfaith and about who should be saying what on Israel and how do we get it together. And I think that that is, you know, again, someone can agree with you or disagree with you, but you have your right to say it. The problem I had is that in the article, they start talking about various organizations and they start saying, well, you know, this organization's unaccountable. That organization doesn't have term limits. This organization doesn't present financials. And it's clear to me that the person who wrote this has some idea about how communal politics works, but clearly doesn't have a total insight because if they did that, they would know, like, some of these things are true or not true. So they got, like, some factual things wrong about the nature of governance in our institutions. And then they go on to sort of a broader strategy question around what should be the role of the Jewish community in talking to the government. And they made some pretty, I think, unfair accusations, particularly amongst the groups that have to deal with government matters, saying, you know, that they're that the leadership needs to be cleaned out, and that there's and that these organizations are unaccountable and having lost their mandate and all sorts of things. And I just thought, you know, if you're going to be anonymous and you want to make broad policy discussions, that's one thing. If you're going to start then coming after organizations and making factually false claims about governance from an anonymous position, that's another. And then if you're going to start calling for things to be changed, well, that's quite something else. And I thought that was, you know, from someone who doesn't have a good knowledge about what's going on, to be making those sorts of claims, I thought was pretty unfortunate and not really fair. I think that if you look all around the world at the Jewish organizations who've had to deal since October 7th with particularly sort of left or center-left parties, doesn't matter whether it's Australia or America or Canada or England, they've all had to deal with one sense or another with now a hostile political environment. And the Jewish community here has been no different. And in fact, we've had it a lot worse because our government is not only hostile towards Israel now, but like actually was embracing Hamas, which really brings me down to the key point of which I disagreed with this particular thing in this national dialogue piece that was written, is that they suggest that organizations, you know, the government might, the ANC rather, might be corrupt and connecting to the terrorists. But, you know, we have to say that there's a difference between the Jewish community here and what's going on in Israel, and we have to deal with the government, and so we should go and talk to them again, you know, because they are the government, they're democratically elected, and we should, and you know, that's, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, and I'm sorry, I just think that that is such a naive view that it's not even a correct, because when you look, first of all, at the fact that the ANC, and then effectively the government through Naledi Pandor's actions, rather, was supporting Hamas, you find that effectively the government is now dealing with a terrorist regime that is harming Jews. And there's like, you know, nothing, they're open about it. So that's the first thing. And that has potential impact on our community here. But second of all, the government, when they went to the ICJ application, it be just before that, they had a meeting with representatives of the Jewish community, and they it was a very aggressive meeting. And then afterwards, they put out this very aggressive statement, and they used that statement as a way, like there's a technicality in the ICJ ruling that if you want to bring something to the ICJ, you need to sort of declare the two different groups have to declare that there is a dispute, technically speaking. So in this case, South Africa actually has to declare that there's a dispute with Israel. And interestingly, this dispute mechanism has been used to exclude parties from having these sorts of debates. They made a special exemption in the case of Israel. So for example, in Sudan, the UAE was coming in and and had a problem with something in Sudan, and they were taken to the ICJ, and people said, no, well, there's no dispute, so you can't have them, there's no jurisdiction. But they made a special case in Israel. And in this particular instance, what actually happened was that the government said that they had met with the South African Jewish community and they had like not been a good meeting, and that therefore justifies them to take Israel to the ICJ. In other words, the government here made a direct connection between the South African Jewish community and Israel, and then pulled us into their dispute with Israel. So they were the ones who erased the line between who is the Jewish community here and who is Israeli interest, not us. You know, the South African Jewish community's perspective has always been that Israel is Israel is Israel. There's an Israeli ambassador. If you have issues you need to address with the Israeli state, you take it up with them. The South African Jews that are here, they have a different perspective, or the same perspective, but they're not the same thing. And the government erased that line by doing this in the ICJ. So until you have a case where the government shifts its position, particularly the ANC shifts its position, I think they're crawling back to the ANC or whatever, and saying, well, you know, we're just Jews here in South Africa, we need to talk to you. Certainly in public, I'm sure there's stuff that goes on in private and whatever, and there's certain things that have to be sorted out. But in public, I don't think that is not even wise, but I think it's probably an unsafe move. And the truth is, we now have a GNU, so you can talk to different ministers about different things. You don't have to deal with the ANC. And I think just strategically, it's an extraordinarily stupid way of doing business, whether we like it or not. It's uncomfortable. Like, obviously, I'd rather have proper relations with the government, but the government kind of stuffed this up, to be frank. And so until we find a point at which there can be some sort of reimagining of this relationship, I don't think that the Jewish community going and talking to them is going to be particularly helpful. Now, you might disagree with me, but I'd be happy to hear one way or another. This is a dialogue after all. 061-895-1019 061-895-1019 is the line. I'd be happy to hear your thoughts on various dialogues of different kinds and what you might think of what is going on at the moment. Let's move abroad now, have a look at something else, and have a discussion around Zoran Mondani and his race for mayor in New York. In case you are not sure about what's going on, so Zoran Mondani, he is a Ugandan national that actually spent some of his childhood in South Africa. His father was a famous academic. He caused a lot of problems at UCT. And then he moved to, they moved to New York. His mother is a famous film director. She did a number of sort of interesting indie films at one point. And anyway, he's running for mayor of New York, and he won the New York Democratic primary. Now, because New York is a Democratic state or city, like by something by like 80% of voters, it means that if you're the primary candidate in the Democratic Party, it means you're likely to be the mayoral candidate and therefore the mayor. He beat out in the primary kind of in a strange way. So first of all, he beat Andrew Cuomo, who was a former governor of New York State, not the city. And he resigned after a variety of scandals involving COVID and some problematic things with to do with women and some other stuff. So he ran against Mamdani. He got destroyed. The actual current sitting Democratic mayor is someone called Eric Adams, who didn't even contest the Democratic primary and is running as an independent. And then you have a couple of other independents, and you have the Republican, who is a weird guy. He used to, like, in the 80s, used to, like, walk around the subways of New York when it was dark and dangerous and sort of do, like, kind of defense league stuff. He wears a weird EFF beret, which I'm not sure, you know, means the same thing in New York as it means here, because he's not the EFF. He's a Republican candidate. So that's the field. And Zoran Mamdani has been doing exceedingly well, right? Never mind the fact that he has a sort of Democratic ticket. He's good on social media. He's young, and he's a very likable, affable politician, and in my view, extremely, because of that, dangerous. He obviously comes with a sort of Islamist background. His father is known for making the argument that Palestinian suicide bombers should be seen as legitimate military soldiers, even when they target civilians. And he himself not only has a vast anti-Israel perspective, including support for boycotts and protests and globalized intifada and all of this, he is also a extreme left-wing, what's known as a democratic socialist. So he's not actually from the Democratic Party itself. And he is... got all sorts of awful ideas economically about state-owned shops and rent controls in housing. And basically what's happened is, because New York has become less and less affordable, he's been able to get involved and push this message of affordability using sort of very old-style state intervention socialist ideas that involve basically raising a lot of taxes and forcing people to do things the way that he wants to do. And that is, you know, quite a serious problem, I think, and one which is now going to be the problem of people in New York if he wins, which it does look like he's likely to do because of the dynamics. First of all, you've got these three very flawed candidates. So the Republican is sort of nice but out of touch. Eric Adams, who is the current mayor but had some, like, sort of corruption scandals, doesn't seem to have done very much. And then Cuomo, who wasn't even popular enough to win the primary, and now is running in the race as an independent. So you have sort of three moderates, none of which are particularly inspiring. In an ideal world, what you would do is sort of get them to all pull out and then sort of try and get the moderate vote to take on Mamdani, but it doesn't look like that is happening at the moment. And so you have a kind of a problem in you splitting the moderate vote and the kind of extremist vote, particularly Zoran Mamdani's voter base is young, white Manhattanites who are single and who particularly feel the affordability crisis. They make the most money, but they also live in the most expensive district, so that they feel it the most. There's, because he is sort of Asian from Uganda, he is very popular amongst the city's large Asian community of different kinds. You know, you've got Pakistanis and Indians and Bangladeshis. New York is a very diverse place, so he has that coalition as well. Some Hispanics also. But if you look at the Democratic primary results, you'll see that there's two districts where he doesn't do very well. The one is Jewish districts or districts where there are a lot of Jews, basically lower Brooklyn and the Upper West Side. And then also in African-American districts. And and those are the two groups that don't seem to have really sort of glommed onto his message. So that is, after the break, what I'm going to be talking about. Because there has been a debate that has broken up to talk about what exactly do the Jews think of Zoran Mamdani and his extreme anti-Israel pro-boycott views. That is the discussion. And after the break, we're going to be talking about what does that actually mean, and actually, are there Jews that support Zoran Mamdani? I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. This is 101.9 Chai FM. I hope that you are all listening out there particularly well. Great to be with you, as always, on the show. Now, before the break, I was talking about this question of Mamdani, and the question about, are there Jews that are supporting this particular candidate for mayor of New York? And some polling was done by this very pro-Mamdani group, has to be said, where they claim that somewhere between 37 and 40%, 42%, something like that, of Jews are actually supporting Mamdani, and particularly in the younger sections of the community, like that he has more support. Now, on the face of it, that does seem like quite a high number, but when you dig into the math, it starts to look the other way, right? So, first of all, New York does have a lot of anti-Zionist Jews. It's the home of like Yiddish theater and all of that sort of thing, which traditionally has an anti-Zionist element to it. And so if there is a place in the world where anti-Zionism is particularly well organized, it is actually in, bizarrely enough, in New York itself, even though the Zionist Jews are sort of more in favor or a larger majority. 64% of Jews in New York, for example, say that they support Israel, which is a very sort of interesting number. And it actually comports almost exactly, if you look at this number. So if 64% of Jews support Israel in New York, and your number of Jews that are supporting Mamdani is in this 40% range, then that's almost nearly 100%, and suggests that maybe what he's managed to do is corral the entire anti-Zionist vote into a single block, and is going to drive it forward in his campaign, but that the rest of the Jews, not to say that they are the majority are anti him, but they're splitting their vote across all different candidates, some for the Republicans, some for Adams, some for Cuomo. But the totality of Jews in New York are still opposed to him. But he's sort of corralled the... It is a disturbing number that you could even get 40% of Jews that could support this guy. Never mind on the anti-Israel stuff, but even just on the anti-American stuff. He's sort of out there and doing that. So I would say that is an interesting aspect. But then if you have a look at further... there are some other polling out which says that this whole process, particularly for campus Jews, has actually radicalized a lot of people. So great example of this is someone like Shabbos Kirstenbaum, who started off as a Bernie supporter and then ended up actually becoming Trump, pro-Trump, and then eventually actually being, he was actually at the Republican convention talking from a Jewish community perspective about support for Trump. So he did a massive flip. And what you've seen in some of the data is that Jews on campuses before October 7th, some 40% of them strongly identified as Democrats. And that number has gone down to 13%, whilst those who identify as conservatives went up from 12 to 18%. So that's kind of an interesting thing. You can see that Jews are reacting to what's going on around them in terms of the campus environment. And whereas the sort of natural inclination of American Jews is to be kind of democratic for a variety of reasons, then suddenly on campus they're sort of being forced to reevaluate the stance in face of the kind of hostility that they're facing on American campuses. So that is an extremely interesting phenomenon. And it kind of suggests that whilst Mamdani might have cornered the market on the anti-Zionist Jews, you actually find that there is actually a sort of center-right shift in the community, particularly amongst young people, and that in 10 or 20 years' time, maybe you see them filtering into some version of the Republican Party when they start to vote or get more political active. So that is an interesting situation, and one in which we will have to look further going ahead into the future. Now, what I can say as well is that we are moving on to the next topic, because I think we've dealt with that. And I wanted to talk about wine, because, you know, wine, you have this this thing where people, you know, they worried about 5-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 20-year-olds. I know it's more like a whiskey thing, but the age of wine makes quite a big difference. And what's interesting for me is that there's now this new wine project that they're starting in Israel, in the Negev. And they're starting it because they found this archaeological site where they found grape seeds from the Byzantine era. So that was sort of the Roman Empire in Christian form. And that was 1,500 years ago, and they were in control of the Negev. And at the time, they were actually able to grow grapes in considerable quantities for export to Europe, talking about several million gallons, apparently, of wine from Israel, which they were able to send then to Europe for export. And what's kind of interesting about it is now the agronomists and the people who are involved with agriculture in Israel have decided that they are going to regrow these grapes and then to try and turn them into wine for consumption. So they found these grapes, they're growing them, they're busy harvesting. It's something they're working on in the Judean Hills with the Israeli Parks Authority. And they're hoping that the grapes that are grown through this ancient variety will be able to regrow grapes that were in Israel 1,500 years ago, and you'll be able to literally enjoy the fruits of people's background and have this historic wine that will get used that was grown all that many years ago, which is, I think, a very cool story and one which we should be following. So we will continue to do so, and I think it will be very, very interesting. I am Benji Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome back to the program. Two items before we end for today. The first one I want to talk about is the hostages in Gaza, and something that we should always keep thinking about under all circumstances, and just something which I have picked up since the hostage programs that we have coming through in different organizations, the Board of Deputies, the Zionist Fed and the JNF and the base and the Sochnut and the Israel Center, bringing out different hostages. And what struck me in the last while has really been the fact that the difference between the hostages that maybe were at Nova and escaped or got out, the hostages that maybe were released after the first 50 days, they were there for a month, and then the hostages that were only released in the sort of later rounds, and the difference in the psychological state of these hostages, and how difficult it is for those who were in longer, you know, the starvation that we've been seeing, and the torture and all of this that we saw, that we're hearing about from these hostages and the psychological effects. And you know, one of the processes and the programs that has been running has been for hostages to come out to South Africa and have a bit of a holiday and just sort of disconnect and go see nature and all of that. And my sense was, okay, you know, whenever the war ends, which hopefully will be soon, you know, this will be a program that, you know, how much longer will we have to run it for? And I got the sense that maybe this might turn out to be a much longer term program, because it's just, you can see the damage that has been done. And I just wonder, you know, as a long-term intervention from our community, what that might actually look like going forward. And that was just some short takeaway from having listened to some of these horrific and harrowing hostage stories that we've been hearing about in the community as people have come out here for some R&R. And then to finish off on one last point, I wanted to talk about the Joburg City Library, which in the last week actually had its opening ceremony, a reopening ceremony. The library closed during COVID in 2020 for renovations. Partly it had to do with COVID, partly it had to do with the fact that the building was not completely safe and there were water issues. And it's the main public library in Joburg. Now, on one sense, people are like, well, you know, are libraries, how relevant even are they these days? Who reads books in physical form that they need to borrow them? But actually, Joburg has a sort of thriving secondhand book market all over the CBD. People do buy books, they trade them. And the library itself, the Joburg City Library, I mean, I haven't been for many years. I wouldn't say I'm a big user of it, but I do know lots of, like, when I was at university, lots of students who didn't have access to places where they could work safely. You know, their homes or the university were noisy and they needed to stay for exams, and people would go there. Also, they have a lot of archival material. So it is an important thing to maintain. And obviously, we do want to get into the 21st century, but they still have a place. And so the fact that the city put this thing under renovation for 5 years, I think was a disgrace. It just shows you how pathetic the leadership is of the city. And it also shows you that there's an election coming next year or the year after. And so they're trying to do whatever they can to actually look like they are delivering. And in the process, they've actually reopened the library. So good for them. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And they had a bit of a launch event last week, and some people went and they had a good time, and it looked like a very interesting place. And yeah, I think that it was something which was a very good experience. And yeah, hopefully that they can keep the library open and the people who need it can get it. Yeah, so at least it is something which is working again in our city, which brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons. Vusi on the sound. To you, dear listener, please join us next week on the New Blue Review.